Good evening, I'm Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. A new administration in Washington means change. And while we as Americans are mostly interested in how our lives at home will be affected, our allies and potential enemies around the world watch for changes in the direction of America's foreign policy. As Colin Powell replaces Madeleine Albright as Secretary of State, and Sandy Berger is replaced by Condoleezza Rice as National Security Advisor, what new relations should others, our allies in Europe in particular, expect? Some nations already sense America pulling back from an active international role. One such observer is Switzerland's ambassador to the United States, Alfred DeFago. An experienced diplomat, DeFago began his career as a radio journalist. Appearing at Boston University's Center for International Relations, Ambassador DeFago spoke on Europe and the United States, two worlds drifting apart. Tonight we'll hear his lecture, after which the ambassador will answer a few of my questions. Then we'll have a roundtable discussion of current American foreign policy and what we might expect in the future. Now here is Ambassador DeFago.
There is always a certain risk in inviting a diplomat to be a guest speaker. As you know, diplomats tend to say things in a very polite and often even evasive way. To be outspoken is certainly not their forte. Winston Churchill even mischievously defined diplomacy as the art of, quote, thinking twice before saying nothing. Today I will do my best to dispel this unflattering image of the diplomatic brotherhood. It is with great pleasure that I have accepted the invitation to be with you and to share some thoughts about the transatlantic dialogue, or to put it more directly, the growing difficulties in the relationship between the United States and Europe. This relationship, let me be clear about this from the beginning, is still quite satisfactory and in many areas even good. But there are signs that the two worlds are drifting apart slowly. How serious is this phenomenon? Where does it lead us? Is it irreversible? And last but not least, what can be done about this shift in Europe and in the U.S.? No Thanks, Uncle Sam. This is the title of a book which has been making headlines in France and beyond for almost a year. Its author, Noël Mamère, a member of the Assemblée nationale, the French parliament, is very clear in his message. France and the rest of Europe have had it with the United States, its society, its culture, and its alleged arrogance in the world. According to Monsieur Noël Mamère, it's time to speak up. At this moment, he says in the closing chapter of his book, quote, it is appropriate to be downright anti-American. Monsieur Mamère is not an isolated case, nor an exception. Books, brochures, and newspaper articles with a clearly anti-American message have rapidly spread all over Europe. In my own country, Michel Bugnot-Mordant, a university professor from the French-speaking part of Switzerland, launched a somewhat vitriolic intellectual attack on what he called l'Amérique totalitaire, totalitarian America, which was even the book's title. Surveys conducted by several European pollsters confirmed the existence of widespread anti-American feelings in many European countries. For example, it may be that Italians are slightly less anti-American than the French, or that in many Eastern European countries, the rejection of everything that reminds them of their Russian-dominated past is still much stronger than any kind of anti-Americanism. But on the whole, there is undoubtedly growing anti-Americanism in the Western, or more precisely, the European world. I deliberately exclude the interesting case of Canada from my consideration in this context, although it would deserve its own updated research in this field. I just was told this morning that there was an article, by the way, also in the Washington Post, written by Martin Kettle, the bureau chief of the British newspaper, The Guardian, 2 weeks ago. I just read it on the plane, and I think it is the title is U.S. Bashing in Europe. And it actually reflects what I'm saying here and he gives some interesting details about the so-called anti-American feelings in Europe. Now, is this phenomenon new? The answer is not a yes or a no. It is a rather a yes and a no. Of course, there has always been anti-Americanism in the transatlantic relationship. From Great Britain and France to Germany and the countries in Central and Eastern Europe, people showed a great deal of skepticism and mistrust towards the sweet temptation of the American dream and the American way of life. People were often afraid of becoming Americanized. The Americanization of the World, this anxious-sounding book title, made headlines not recently, but when it was published by its British author, William Stead, in 1901. Since then, literally hundreds of books, studies, and articles have dealt with this issue on both sides of the Atlantic. But now, there seems to be something new in this discussion, something we haven't heard as loud or as clear earlier in this debate. So what is this new element? The New York Times has made the point recently. Criticism of the U.S. is not new, the newspaper said, but the vituperation is. In other words, criticism, skepticism, some head-shaking, and sometimes a great deal of mutual misunderstanding have always been a part of the transatlantic dialogue. New on the European side, however, is the fact that with this criticism comes a dangerous undertone of scorn, disdain, and even plain hostility. This is new, indeed, and that is why we should, on both sides of the Atlantic, thoroughly look into the reasons for this interesting phenomenon. By the way, today almost everything can and will be used in Europe as an argument against the U.S. The fact that a clear majority in the U.S. support capital punishment, for example, as a weapon against the excesses of a violent society, triggers in Europe widespread bewilderment and or even a total lack of understanding. Moreover, the U.S. is regarded among many Europeans, and that's just an observation, that's not a moral or a personal assessment. The U.S. is regarded among many Europeans as anything but a role model with respect to welfare or social services. Let's put aside here whether it's correct or not. This is just an observation. Finally, Europeans tend to ridicule the American lifestyle and its many ramifications, the allegedly horrible cuisine and other things, which Europeans regard as typical products of American mass culture. Hollywood and the worldwide predominant American media are other popular targets of European disdain and spite. However, Europe, this very same Europe, sometimes seems to adore and even devour precisely what it pretends to unequivocally condemn. According to all statisticians, polls, the average Europeans seem to love American fast food, Hollywood movies, and exciting vacations in the New World. And even the most sophisticated European intellectuals are strongly suspected of secretly indulging in these pleasures they publicly scorn. On this side of the Atlantic, Americans are much less outspoken in their views on the old world. Of course, there is a certain American admiration for what is perceived as European history, culture, and civilization, and sophistication. On the other hand, it is true that there is, or was, especially in the past, also something like a long-standing American tradition cultivating disdain for the old world. In this view, Europe is or was a world in decline, a world of the past, burdened with history, a very complicated history, and clearly inferior to the new world, a world full of freedom, vigor, optimism, and prosperity. But anti-European feelings in this country are nowadays much weaker than anti-American resentments in Europe. Today, an increasing number of Americans tend to show a benign, I would say benign, indifference if they are asked their attitude towards Europe. But let us get back to the core of our issue. What makes it today more difficult to entertain a sound and productive transatlantic dialogue? In other words, what are the reasons for the drifting apart between Europe and the U.S.? The reasons are actually rather simple to determine. First, for the past 40 to 45 years, there was an element in the European-American relationship that has never existed before and most probably will not exist in their original intensity in the future. I'm talking about the strong will to form a transatlantic community unified through the existence of the considerable Soviet-Russian threat. The visible embodiment of this will to defend was NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, conceived as a vigorous response to the Soviet-Russian challenge. This challenge and threat are gone. NATO, of course, still exists and is even talking about further enlargement. But NATO as a historically decisive instrument which welded North American and Western Europe together to fight against the Soviet-Russian system, this NATO no longer exists. Secondly, the generation of American and European leaders who created NATO and fought for the principles which NATO stood for during the Cold War are disappearing from the scene. In Europe, a new generation of leaders without significant political experience to the hot days of the Cold War is now in power. Transatlantic dialogue doesn't mean the same to them as to their predecessors. The world of Margaret Thatcher, François Mitterrand, Helmut Kohl has gone. New faces like Tony Blair, Gerhard Schröder, Lionel Jospin, and others dominate the stage. On the American side, it is even more obvious that a generational change is in full swing. It is true, the old East Coast establishment internationalists are still visible and have a say in the general geopolitical debate. And, for example, Madeleine Albright, herself a figure with a strong European background, used to emphasize the importance of a strong transatlantic partnership. And from my own discussions with Colin Powell, I can assume that the new Bush administration will stress this point too. But the international discussion in Washington is clearly shifting to other, for the U.S., just as important or even more important regions in the world. Already, Madeleine Albright's predecessor, Warren Christopher, a man with a distinct West Coast and Pacific background, took office in 1993, warning against an overly, as he said, Eurocentric foreign policy. By the way, this shift from a Eurocentric to a more open, particularly a Pacific, Asian-oriented foreign policy doesn't only have to do with the retreat of the East Coast establishment. The U.S. itself has undergone a remarkable shift from the East to the West, and this fact is probably one of the most plausible explanations for the inevitable new orientation of U.S. foreign policy. Sometimes it is amazing how Europeans, even political leaders and intellectuals, don't realize this fundamental shift in America's strategic, political, and economic alignment. They often see the U.S. in its traditional role as a predominantly Atlantic power with strong historical and cultural ties with the old world. This is still true, no doubt about that, no doubt, but that the very same USA is on its way to becoming a Pacific power as well, a power which also has extended its bonds with Latin America. These facts are strangely suppressed by many Europeans. They don't see that the percentage of U.S. citizens of European background is clearly declining and that the European immigration was largely replaced over the last couple of last decades by immigrants from Asia and Latin America. Europeans don't seem to realize either that there is a significant westward shift in the U.S. population from the Atlantic to the Pacific. The U.S. Census Bureau statistics tell us that in 1950, approximately 27% of the population lived in the Northeast, a region traditionally fostering strong cultural and economic ties with Europe. Only 14% lived in 1950 in the West. That has dramatically changed. In 1995, approximately 22% of the U.S. population lived in the West, while the Northeasterners accounted only for 19%. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, this trend will not only continue, but even accelerate. And the latest figures I saw a couple of weeks ago really confirms this trend. This shift westward will inevitably lead to a shift in the geopolitical orientation of the country. The third reason for this ongoing separation between the U.S. and Europe is partially the result of the demographic development I just outlined. While still very strong and close, the economic ties between the U.S. and Europe are slowly weakening. This development is certainly not dramatic, at least not for the time being. But the statistics speak for themselves. Asia surpassed Europe as the main market for U.S. trade as far back as 1983. Now, 17 or 18 years later, this U.S.-Asian trade is already more than 1.5 times larger than trade with Europe. There is no indication that this trend will stop or even be reversed. What may surprise many at first is the fact that U.S. direct investment in Europe is still larger than in Asia. And in terms of European investment in the U.S., for example, Swiss investment in the U.S. alone is larger than direct investment here from Latin America, Africa, and Asia, with the exception of Japan, all combined. Nevertheless, times are changing, and also in this field, the gap has begun to close. This gradual shift in international trade and investment will almost automatically lead American policymakers to focus more on Asia, the Pacific Rim, and Latin America as important political, economic, and cultural partners and competitors. And finally, Europeans too will redefine their economic and trade priorities. More and more Europeans will appear not only as partners, but also as strong and self-confident competitors and even rivals of the U.S. in the markets in Asia, Latin America, and Africa. Having considered all these facts and views, what does it historically mean for American-European relations? As a historian, I should be extremely cautious when it comes to predicting the future and even to talk about the significance of the past for the future. The late communist Chinese prime minister, the well-educated Mr. Chu Enlai, was once asked his opinion of the significance of the French Revolution in 1789. His astonishing answer, "It's too soon to tell." That may be even more true in our case. It is perhaps too soon to tell what will happen with the transatlantic idea in the decades to come. However, there are some clear historical and political indicators which allow us to be a bit bolder or at least less cautious than Mr. Chu Enlai. So what does the latest development in the transatlantic community mean for American-European relations? Let me briefly make three points. First, in spite of all solemn declarations and nostalgic memories, the heyday of the transatlantic idea is over. Transatlantism in its best days was the result of the serious threat by the Soviet system. That system has gone, and so has the unique cohesion of the transatlantic community, which was actually welded together precisely by the communist threat. The disappearance of the Soviet challenges has not eliminated this transatlantic idea as such, but this idea has been transformed into a much looser kind of concept. It is now a concept of a partnership of two worlds which still have a lot in common, but increasingly also have clearly different views and interests in many areas. We should accept this fact without any ifs, ands, or buts. Secondly, we should also accept, and I think we should accept and comprehend it particularly in Europe, that the U.S. has become a less Europe and more Pacific and Latin America-oriented society. The cultural and societal bonds of the U.S. with those partners steadily become closer and stronger, while the relations with the old world will relatively lose some of their importance. But thirdly, let us not jump to the conclusion that the days of a dynamic, proactive transatlantic dialogue are over. On the contrary, precisely because the well-defined framework of the transatlantic cooperation during the Cold War has gone or is at least eroding, we need to work hard on the continuation and further development of this community. While soberly recognizing the fact that both Europe and the U.S. are slowly but surely drifting apart, we should leave no stone unturned to protect and safeguard the core of the transatlantic idea and its most successful history. It was and still is a history which is based on amazingly many common values and principles. These simple core values and principles, such as freedom, freedom of speech, rule of law, social and personal responsibility, etc., have grown in the fertile ground of a common history and common experiences. It is true, as I said, the great days of the transatlantic community are over, and that the dialogue going back and forth across the Atlantic will become more demanding and sometimes even difficult. But we owe history, and in this case a very successful history, to further develop these relations under new and different circumstances. And if we do it, we will survive the occasional notes of discord when Uncle Sam and Lady Europe play together. Thank you very much.
Alfred DeFago, Switzerland's ambassador to the United States. I spoke with him following his lecture.
Mr. Ambassador, could you tell us a little bit more about what the Secretary of State, now Colin Powell, indicated to you about future U.S.-European relations in your conversation with him?
That's more an interpretation of what he said than his words themselves. But I think Europe will have, in spite of all the criticism that came from some European governments or some critical questions, I think there will be a reliable transatlantic relationship also under the Bush government. But, of course, in terms of Europe, also in this respect, the new government, the new Bush administration, will define the national interest in a, I would say, more precise way than maybe the Clinton administration. That seems to me quite clear, but that doesn't mean that there is a loosening process of the American-European relations. On the contrary, and Colin Powell knows Europe quite well, and he will be very open to a strong Europe, not only European Union, but strong European countries. Still, the majority of European countries are not members of the European Union, and he will be open. But once again, I think there will be some attempt to define the American national interest in a more precise way.
What was Europe's reaction to the comments of the national security designate, Condoleezza Rice, when she mentioned the possibility of bringing U.S. troops out of Kosovo? How did Europe react to that?
There was, at the very first moment, kind of an outburst among journalists and even some more or less hidden criticism among officials in several countries. But I think finally they saw that this was just a point that was made by the American government deliberately to define or to tell Europeans, to give them a message that they should take their own responsibility more seriously in terms of their involvement in European affairs. I think it's, in the long run, indeed, not a normal situation that Americans have to intervene sometimes even on behalf of Europeans. For example, in the context of former Yugoslavia, America heavily intervened and intervened also because there was a great reluctance to do something among Europeans. So Europeans should be actually very, I would say, even grateful that Americans did this. But once again, this was a clear signal to Europeans that they should do more, and that particularly in Europe itself.
Mr. Ambassador, could you elaborate a bit on what the core values are that Europe and the United States share? You spoke of that in your speech, but I'm interested in going a little further with that.
I think we have a lot of, because we have a lot of history in common, we have a lot of traditions in common, and among these traditions is certainly cultural traditions like, for example, Americans pursue the idea of freedom in a very European way. Of course, you would see also some differences in this respect. Freedom in Europe means not necessarily exactly the same, but nevertheless, this has certainly a European root. And also freedom of speech as a practical application of freedom is a generally Western, European, American, European value. Also personal responsibility. And this sometimes is stressed more here in the United States than in Europe. And these are all, in my opinion, core values that bring us together. And that's what the transatlantic relationship can count on and is based on. And therefore, I think these are still core elements in Europe and core elements here in the United States.
One of the interesting things that you said was that the disagreements or the anti-Americanism grows more out of reaction to cultural situations than political points. Could you go into that a bit?
In a way, there is a very paradoxical relationship going on between the United States and Europe. On the one hand, Americans don't care too much about this relationship because they take it for granted and they don't see even the problem of anti-Americanism. I realize that, for example, in my presentations here in the United States. It's totally different in Europe. Last week, for example, I was in Switzerland and gave presentations, and it happened twice that all the questions were certainly worded in a, I can't say totally anti-American way, but questions were quite bitter, and there was always a bitter undertone and some criticism involved in the question itself. And therefore, it's a cultural problem in the first place. On the one hand, Europeans don't like the products of what they call the invasion of American mass culture. Hollywood films or fast food culture, everything that is actually perceived as bad is perceived as inherently also American. I exaggerate now a little bit.
It goes with your idea of globalization being perceived as Americanization.
Exactly. And at the same time, and that's the paradox here, American mass culture is extremely popular with Europeans, and even among intellectuals, they maybe in a more hidden way, but they like it as well. And therefore, I think it's difficult to explain this relation. But I think it's a growing feeling of anti-Americanism. That's for sure. And it became stronger after the Cold War because, as I said in my speech, it has maybe something to do with the fact that now America is the only superpower left.
Let me ask you if that cultural divide is also generational. Is it the young people that like the mass culture and the older people that are turning away?
Baby boomers are very heavily involved in the consumption of American mass culture. What I was really astonished and surprised to see how many young people actually have prejudices and some very negative feelings about the United States. And in their case, they are open to American mass culture, but at the same time, they feel guilty about that in a way. I think it's really a paradoxical situation.
Thank you very much.
Ambassador Alfred DeFago. Joining me now are two people uniquely qualified to react to what we've just heard and to comment on the future of American foreign policy. They are Professor Doug Sears, Associate Dean of the School of Education, and a former tenured officer in the Foreign Service. Sears' career as a diplomat includes a stint in the American Embassy in Switzerland. He was awarded the U.S. Department of State Meritorious Honor Award in 1988. And also with us is University Professor Leah Greenfeld, political scientist and expert on nationalism. Professor Greenfeld is the author of Nationalism, Five Roads to Modernity, and is currently studying the impact of economics on nationalism. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Ted. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Let's deal first of all with Ambassador DeFago's basic premise that the United States and Europe are drifting apart. Do you accept that?
I would say that they are not drifting apart, that they are apart, and there is not much change today from what we witnessed, let's say, in the beginning of the 20th century. And in fact, Ambassador DeFago quoted a British book called Americanization of the World, a book that was published in 1901. At the very same time, 3 years before, there was another British book that was called Made in Germany, that dealt with the Germanization of the world.
Hmm.
2 decades later, another book appeared that was called Made in Japan. It was a repetition of Made in Germany, and that was a book dealing with the terrible consequences of Japanization of the world. All those countries are rivals. They are competitors, this is what they were for at least a century. A century before that, Britain in particular did not have any competitors. And this is how they see each other.
Professor Sears.
Well, I mean, as I heard the ambassador and I attended the talk, he was stating, I think, that it wasn't really something to worry about, particularly simply an accomplished fact that there had been some drift. It was a consequence of the Cold War's ending and the greater economic weight that we assigned to the Pacific. And that's the sort of the gravitational pull rather than a major cultural or a disaffection among the...
But he made the point that he saw a rise in anti-Americanism, which he felt was, a strongly emotionally based. Do you sense that? Do either of you sense that?
Well, there is anti-Americanism. I don't know if it is possible to talk about anti-Americanism. There was anti-Americanism for at least the last 70 years, very, very pronounced anti-Americanism. Before the Second World War in Germany, lots of books were published that could not have been more anti-American, and this was because, from the German point of view, America was becoming the, if not the main rival of Germany as the major power, then at least a rival on a par with Britain. Just after the Second World War, there were remarkably anti-American expressions of remarkably anti-American opinion in France and in some other countries. Now, Ambassador DeFago mentioned some French examples, he mentioned some Swiss examples, but he said that, for instance, in Italy or in Eastern Europe, you don't see so much anti-Americanism. Europe is not a unity.
Mm.
And the Swiss example is a case in point. Mm-hmm. Switzerland is not a part and doesn't want to be a part of a European unity. But even if we are speaking about the union, clearly certain countries within it are more parts of the union than others. You know, everyone mm-hmm. is equal, but some mm-hmm. are more equal than others. And they have very different attitudes to America, where we do see, and we have seen for a very long time, despite the fact that Americans do not want to perceive that, as they don't even now, according to Ambassador DeFago, where we do see anti-American opinion, those are the leaders of the union, that is France and Germany. This is where we see anti-American opinion.
Do you agree with that?
I think it is. I'm not certain it's a new phenomenon, and I'm not even certain it's something that we need to pay a whole lot of attention to. In fact, I think it's a mere function of America's power and an almost inevitable consequence of our relative weight in the world and the fact that I think in the main we do not abuse that power. We are actually quite restrained as superpowers go, considering our sheer weight in the world. It's almost easier to resent a superpower that is not as abusive in its conduct to its neighbors and friends as other superpowers have been.
In fact, I agree completely, and I very much like the word that you used, resent, because this is, in general, a question of identity. And in the formation of identity, the most admired object of imitation plays a very important role. And for states or nations powerful in the past, such as France and Germany, the United States now represents such a model, and that's why Ambassador DeFago emphasized several times that we both love the United States and all those things against which we militate, and at the same time we resent them. And in the formation of identity, especially on the part of such previously powerful nations, a very interesting psychological phenomenon, ressentiment, plays a very important role. They both try to model themselves on the United States, and at the same time, they see the United States as the mirror of their current inferiority. And this is the reason for their resentment. And that's why you don't see such anti-American feeling in Italy, for instance, because Italy still measures itself much more against France, for instance, and Britain, or Germany, so it would it is much more likely to resent those countries rather than to resent Americans. Or you don't see anti-American feeling in Ireland, for instance, because the entity that they resent is the United Kingdom, and the Americans are the enemy of the enemy. So in fact, they would like them.
At this point, I want to ask both of you and open this up for general discussion. What do you think we can expect from America in the near future, from Secretary of State Powell, President George W. Bush, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice? Have they given any indication of the direction yet that they think foreign policy should take?
Well, if I may, one thing I think will become more evident is some recognition that the world, a greater clarity about the dangers in the world. I think this administration is a little more mature about the notion that the world is full of some dangerous characters, some dangerous situations, and that being prepared to meet those dangers is there's nothing crass or wrong about being prepared to meet those dangers. And I think you get a mature sense of how to deal with real risks. And maybe it even boils down to a somewhat more traditional view of human nature, a somewhat less sunny assessment of human nature, which, of course, can translate into a form of arrogance if it's unreflective. If you forget that you have a lot of power also in a dangerous world, it does translate into dangerous arrogance. But a sense that the world is dangerous, that there is such a thing as evil, rather than that conflicts are some sort of mechanical accident, I think is part of what will inform this administration. And I don't think we should underestimate the president's perceptiveness about that. Texans play a lot of football.
I saw you nodding, Professor.
Yeah. Well, I am fundamentally in agreement with what I say and what I get from the various campaign speeches confirmation speeches of the people who would be involved in the formation of our foreign policy is that the United States may, without for a moment becoming isolationist, would abandon its very dangerous interventionist stance. Its definition of itself as the world's policeman getting into absolutely everywhere in the world for no reason at all, and specifically when no American interests are involved, and that its foreign policy will be guided by a clear understanding of American interests, including our interests in establishing democracy and guiding and guarding democracy in the world.
You're listening to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Ted O'Brien. Our guests are University Professor Leah Greenfeld, political science and an expert on nationalism,
And Professor Doug Sears from the School of Education, a former Foreign Service officer who served in both Asia and Europe with a distinguished record in both places. Let me just step back for a moment and challenge you both. In 1991-92, the Bosnian crisis flared up under President Bush's father, and it was Secretary of State James Baker who said at that time, "We have no dog in that fight." As it turned out, we ultimately were drawn in. Would you agree or disagree that the United States did the right thing under the Clinton administration in getting involved in that part of the world? Doug, I'll toss that hot potato at you. It's a complicated problem.
Very tough one.
This is a very tough question.
Yes, of course.
It's a very tough question to answer when posed in those terms. But what the Clinton administration did, it would be much better, I firmly believe, for the Bosnians if it didn't do that.
If it had stayed out.
If it had stayed out.
All right.
If it had stayed out, and if it had not imposed upon Bosnia the kind of peace that was imposed, and perhaps before that, if it had not imposed the embargo on all the parties, and if it had not played and emphasized this absolutely, I wouldn't say ridiculous, this is not the word, this absolutely unacceptable under the conditions, morally unacceptable under the conditions, position of objectivity. One could not be objective when a party of killers was burning children locked in buildings. There were no two sides, you know, between which one had difficulty of adjudicating.
And yet Europe at that point did not appear to be willing to step up and put out that flare-up or that house fire in their own neighborhood.
Well, I'm thinking of it from a military standpoint as the starting point, and I understand, although I'm not a specialist on this, that General Powell is one who's reluctant to use force easily. And a lot of military people, and again, my limited experience, are quite prudent because they understand the law of unintended consequences, they understand risk, and they know that you can't do clean wars, and the minute you start thinking you can go in and cleanly use air power, you know, one of the enduring myths or hopes is that you use air power in clean ways to punish someone from above. Almost it's a deus ex machina. Mm. When you start thinking that way, you get drawn in slowly into various messy situations where your intervention produces consequences very different from those you would hope for.
What do you think the future in that part of the world is? I asked the ambassador if Europe was shocked by the Condoleezza Rice statement to the effect that, you know, perhaps American troops ought to come out of Kosovo, the sector, the eastern sector, which they're now occupying. And as you heard, he said it was a wake-up call that Europe had best begin taking care of its own problems. You've studied nationalism and the intensity of the differences, Professor Greenfeld, in people who want to hang on to that idea that this is their place, their land, and the other people here are homogeneous. They're like me. Can Europe ever come up with a unified response to these kinds of atrocious activities?
I'm not very optimistic on this score. But I don't think that that anyone can impose a solution for a problem of this nature on anyone else. And in the end, the South Slavs, the Yugoslavs, would have to sort it out between themselves. I don't think that our intervention, especially half-hearted intervention, which it was, this is the most important thing about it, that our intervention would help. It would help more, perhaps, if they knew from the very beginning that we would not intervene, and then they would not expect our intervention and would not shape their behavior in accordance with their expectations. I do not know whether Europe, which again is not an entity, that is where, whether those different European nations that have very different views and very different interests in that particular region, whether they can come up with a policy that would contribute to an equitable solution of the problem. It's possible that we have to let history run its course because this is what it does in any case.
I think it's always painful to really decide how a nation or even a group of nations should address those things, because if you choose to do nothing, you know of horrible things that happen, and yet sometimes the doing something can actually exacerbate or cause worse, and it's a very, very hard thing to get into.
Well, let's bring it down to the question of American troops then. The Pax Americana holding the fort, NATO over the last 40 years since the end of the war has provided a cover for economic growth and prevention of all-out war. Should the troops come out?
Despite what Ambassador DeFago said as to the end to the Russian or Soviet, yes, the Soviet threat ended. But Russia is a direct descendant of the Soviet Union. So there is no end to the Russian threat. Russia is a very, very serious possible menace. Russia, in its ideology, the ideology of its ruling elite, and the ideology of its possible ruling elite that might replace this current ruling elite, is passionately and bitterly nationalistic, anti-Western, and very specifically anti-American. So the moment Russia gets back on its feet, which, given what Russia is, will happen probably sooner rather than later. It is a very, very powerful nation, and it has the chance, the possibility, given its resources, to be the most powerful nation in the world. After all, it is the largest country in the world with the largest amount of natural resources and with the most educated labor force. So the moment Russia gets back on its feet, it would not be a nice and peaceful collaborator of the United States. Therefore, it remains very directly in the American interest to keep a strong presence in Europe and to keep the North Atlantic organization going strong. Now, Western Europe, unprotected by NATO, is unprotected Western Europe. In its history, Russia never was aggressive against a stronger competitor, but it invariably was aggressive if it perceived any weakness. Now, what the Europeans propose is that they would have 60,000 troops, you know, kind of their own. What is 60,000 troops when one deals with Russia? So, of course, the United States has to keep...
A dab won't do you.
So, further comment,
Well, Doug. I agree. It doesn't make for a good dialogue on radio, I suppose, but I agree that you need the troops there. I think this may sound unfair to the Europeans, but they will not, because they are not a unity, they will not summon the will to provide the kind of troop strength in Europe that would protect against a threat of that magnitude. And we do have an interest there. We have an interest, I mean, from an economic standpoint, if you think about Ricardo, you want the advantages of productivity. Even if you're competing, it's good to have a powerful, economically strong, vibrant Europe competing with us in trade, stable. It's a wonderful place that produces good microphones, for example. We want Europe strong, free, and unfortunately, we will have to do it whether we like it or not.
In the case of America vis-a-vis the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union, Is there anything that we could do, or the Bush administration could do, since they're handling foreign policy, that would facilitate less chaos over there and still be a positive thing in terms of their future? And I say this knowing that after World War II, the governments of both Japan and Germany were totally reconstructed in a democratic model, which seems to have held. Do you see anything possible like that in the...
No, it is not possible to reconstruct one-sixth of the Earth's surface in the same way in which it is possible to occupy and reconstruct a small country, which is equal to one of American states, and perhaps a very small American state if we are dealing with Japan. So no such, and nothing but such presence, that is occupation and imposition of a regime, would do that. Now, a strong Russia, that is a less chaotic Russia, is not in American interest, in fact. A less chaotic Russia is an authoritarian, nationalistic, and aggressive Russia. So what Americans can do to, the best Americans can do to guard American national interests is to be strong vis-a-vis Russia.
Well, on that note, I'll say thank you to both of you, and most grateful, and we've had this opportunity. I'm not sure that Ambassador DeFago knew what he was kicking off with his speech. But thank you both very much.
It's very interesting, Ted. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture on the future of European-American relations delivered at Boston University by Switzerland's ambassador to the United States, the Honorable Alfred DeFago, followed by an interview and a roundtable discussion on the future of American foreign policy in general. Participants included University Professor Leah Greenfeld, political scientist and expert on nationalism, and Professor Doug Sears, Associate Dean of the School of Education and a former tenured officer in the Foreign Service. Join us next week for another edition of The World of Ideas as we look at power and the implications of deregulation. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. You can access us on the web at wrni.org and wbur.org. Tonight's program was produced by Stephen Belter and Bob Zalisk. Our webmaster is Amy.